everybody, and welcome back to another bonus edition of Truth and Justice. I gotta tell you that I am really excited to be speaking with my guest today. Most of you know Mara Leverett because of her groundbreaking book, The Devil's Knot, which was later turned into a scripted movie starring Reese Witherspoon playing Pam Hobbs. But Mara has been a powerhouse of an investigative journalist in the criminal justice space for decades. And what I really love about Mara is how genuine she is. I think back to Sarah Koenig, the creator of the Serial podcast. She convinced us all that she genuinely cared about finding justice for Haman Lee and Anand Syed. But after the podcast concluded, Koenig disappeared and has nothing to do with Anand's current legal battle. The same cannot be said about Mara Leverett. She published The Devil's Knot nearly 20 years ago, and today she's still in the fight, firing off open records requests and still insisting on answers from the West Memphis Police Department. She is the best of the best, and she joins me today to update all of you on her progress and her continued fight for justice for not only the West Memphis 3, but also for the victims that we have referred to as the forgotten West Memphis 3. Right after a short break, we'll jump right into my conversation with Mara Leverett.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, I'm joined today by someone who, if you have any kind of familiarity with the West Memphis 3 case, you definitely know this name. Her name is Mara Leverett, and she is the author of the book, The Devil's Knot. Mara, thanks so much for taking time to sit down with me today.
I'm glad to do it, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, oh, it's my pleasure. First of all, I definitely want to get into the things that you've been doing recently with the West Memphis 3 case. But prior to that, in case there's anybody listening that isn't familiar with your work, can you talk about the creation of The Devil's Knot, the work you did for that case, and what became of it?
Okay. Well, I've been a reporter in Arkansas for a long time, and I had eventually become interested. I'd seen some stories that struck me as deserving more than just newspaper articles or magazine articles. And they were stories that involved crimes where I began to realize we were not being told the whole story. And so that led me to do one book called Boys on the Track. After that, that's about two murders, very, very strange murders that remain unsolved and very suspicious to this day. Then I turned my attention to the West Memphis case and wrote Devil's Knot. And then after that, I wrote, after the Alford plea and the guys got out of prison 10 years ago, I joined with Jason Baldwin to write a book about his story, his experience in that, being the youngest and going off being charged with these murders and having prosecutors asking for the death penalty for him at the age of 16. But when he got out, he agreed, and we did that book called Dark Spell. And then most recently, I just finished another book that involves another high-profile criminal who had some time in Arkansas, the smuggler turned federal informant Barry Seal. And that book is called All Quiet at Mena. So to go into and at the time that I wrote all, I had no intention of writing the book about Barry Seal, except that I was asked to. But at the time that came up, I was planning to write a third book about the West Memphis case. So that was put on hold. But now with the work that you've done, Bob, I'm really glad I didn't at that point, because obviously there's a lot more to the story.
Well, you know, the work you did, I admittedly, my first introduction to your work was the Devil's Knot movie. And then after watching it, I found out that came from a book and then read your book. And it was just fascinating and also just so impressive, the amount of research that you did. Can you talk about the process? How long? Because the book came out, was it 2002?
I think so. I think that sounds right. And my books take years to write. And it actually started the first anything I wrote for publication about the West Memphis case was the October, the second trial was in, I think, May or June of 94. And that October, I went to I filed my first Freedom of Information request with the West Memphis Police, and it was to see all the evidence, ironically. And I went to the police department, and I got to spend a couple of days in the evidence room. But one of the things that I saw there were the two transcripts of the confession taken from Jesse Miss Kelly. And I was so shocked by what I saw in those that I wrote a column saying the scariest story I know to tell you this Halloween is about what happened in West Memphis. And that was back in 1994. Then finished. I wrote the other book about the boys on the track, and then went straight into writing about the West Memphis trial. And I've often thought, looking back, that even at the time, I felt that I was looking at a magician's act, kind of trying to learn the tricks and how things were done, so that the appearance of something being done properly was there for the audience to see. But there were many things happening that the magician knew and that were going on out of sight of the audience that made it all turn out the way it did. And that image stays with me as to what that experience of seeing the transcripts and talking to people and writing that book was like.
Yeah, because you went so much deeper. You know, the case gained popularity because of the Paradise Lost movies. But, you know, they were following along the trial, but they didn't seem to be digging super deep into, you know, anything much further beyond the surface of the case. And I was astounded when I read your book how deep you got in the people, you know, who were, I guess for people, you know, they have to go read the book to get the whole story, but Can you share some of the revelations that you found through the writing of the book and the research for the book that maybe people weren't aware of who had just seen, say, Paradise Lost, and that was their introduction to the case?
Well, I always credit Paradise Lost tremendously with with the outcome, everything that happened.
Yeah, definitely.
In this case, all the attention that came to it sprang from the work that those filmmakers did, and it was terrific. One of the most interesting asides from that I learned later on, much later in talking to them, was that they were negotiating, talking to the people there, the officials, about trying to get permission. It's legal in this state to film trials. It almost never happens, though, because prosecutors don't want to, because they're all planning to, no, I shouldn't say that, but many of them are looking towards their political futures and thinking something stupid might show up in a ad against them if it was all recorded. And then on the other hand, defense lawyers want to protect the future of their clients and don't want anything that they might be embarrassed by coming out, being available in recording. So, and judges, same thing. So everybody's kind of got an interest in not getting this recorded. So there was a lot of effort that had to go into that, to making those films. And one of the things for Jesse and Ms. Kelly's, the first trial, they told me that as they were up there sitting in, they were allowed to sit in with the county officials and just kind of be at the table while plans were being made for this trial and security and everything else. And then the question came up, well, what about letting them film it? And somebody said, well, I don't think our microphone system, our sound system is good enough to really be a good enough for film quality. And they jumped in and said, well, we'll just put in a new sound system for the courthouse.
They did.
And that's sort of how history gets made in a lot of ways. They said, oh, well, a new sound system for the courthouse. That sounds great. And so that permission was granted. And then the second trial, of course, as well after that. I was also very struck by the fact, by John Mark Byers' criminal background. There was not anything much known about that, but he had had a conviction for taking a cattle product, a stun gun, basically, used for cattle, to his former wife in a domestic dispute. And he was convicted of terroristic threatening. And then that conviction was sealed by the court, by Judge Burnett, because he was going to become a police informant. And he did. And then he was later arrested in Memphis across the river with guns and drugs in his trunk of his car. And the U.S. Marshals took over his case, and that was the end of it. That's where the trail went cold on him. And so I thought, my gosh, what else is going on in with this group of people that we don't know anything about? And one time when I found out that I actually was able to get the records on Byers that had been sealed, I think someone at the clerk's office just goofed and let me see them. And I was outside the Crittenden County Courthouse one day, and Judge Burnett came out, and I asked him about it, and he was so upset. He was just furious that had happened, that I had been able to find out about that. So a lot of things like that.
Yeah, I'm sure they sort of tied the hands. Well, not sort of. They absolutely tied the hands of the defense through both trials. What was the process like when the movie got, or the book got optioned for a movie? Was that something you were pursuing, or did someone come to you about that?
I wasn't pursuing that, but I was approached by the producer who ended up making it. And there were a couple of different scripts written for it, and I got a good education in how hard it is to get a movie made, and get a movie that is especially like this, that has so many ways that it could go wrong. And I was very grateful for every effort that was made to tell the story, and also then to stick as closely as possible to the truth of it. And in that regard, one of the things that really impressed me was how much of the cast were not U.S. citizens. There were Canadians. The director was a Canadian. Then there were cast members from New Zealand, I believe, Australia, who were, like many people from, as I'm sure you've found, from other countries, who were really distressed by this story and shocked that it could happen in the United States, because they had such a high opinion of our justice system. So it was gratifying to get to see that commitment, and they all took it very, very seriously, that this was an important thing.
Yeah, that's great. Did you get to have much involvement once the film was being made, or once it was optioned, were you kind of out of the loop?
Well, usually the once it's optioned, you're out of the loop, and it's a dicey thing for authors. I was fortunate that the producer promised me on the front end that I would be able to see everything that was being planned and object to anything that I found, you know, unacceptable. And so my commitment was that I respect that they're making a movie, and they're not making a documentary, and they're not making a book. And so that there were differences in the way things had to be done, and that these are artists and people who are professional in their own right. So fortunately, we had a very respectful relationship in that regard, and I appreciated it.
Well, that's great. Did you get to meet any of the cast? Reese Witherspoon comes to mind in particular.
Well, actually, one of the things that was very nice was that the producers invited Jason and me, and I don't know if anybody else was. I think that the others were invited too, but at least Jason and I went to Georgia, where the film was being where it was being filmed, on this wonderful courthouse that was being used, and got to spend a day just hanging out and seeing how it was done. And that was really just a kindness being extended to us. And so I got to, Reese Witherspoon was there, but she was very much more protective. I think she was pregnant at the time, and she was taking her downtime to herself. But Colin Firth was there having lunch with the crew and the wardrobe people and us, and he was just a very ordinary guy on the set, and that was a real pleasure for me to meet him as well as the other cast members. Everybody was just kind of ordinary folks, and you know, putting their heart and soul into this project, and at that point, you know, it had just been, the guys had just recently been released. And so there was a lot of trying to understand what had happened, even there on the set. How did this happen? How could this have happened? And what was the Alfred play all about?
Right.
So it was, it was a lot of what's gone on with everybody who gets interested in this. A lot of trying to understand it, and a lot of taking it seriously.
Well, that's awesome. You get to do that experience, and I thought they did a fantastic job with the movie. And I think it brought in awareness to a whole new group of people that maybe don't watch documentaries, but people that are just watching scripted movies. It gave them some awareness of the case.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And one thing that I've always been impressed with about your work is that you really seem to stick with this case, you know, this case in particular. You know, you didn't write the book and then just move on to the next thing. You've still stayed involved, and that's kind of what I'd like to talk about now. Is, you know, after we did the year long podcast series and then the TV series, you know, we finally got a big push again from the general public against the DA's office to try to get some evidence retested. And you know, my audience is familiar with the story. I know you are too. That, you know, through the pressure that came from the audience, the Scott Ellington agreed to test the evidence. We had emails going back and forth to the point where he was, you know, last August was asking for the FedEx account number for the lab we were going to send the items to. And then he just ghosted us. And then he just stopped replying to any emails. And then we have a new DA takes over. And then the new DA comes out this winter and says, the evidence is all gone. Some of it's been destroyed. We can't find it. My feeling all along at that point was that he was lying. I know I talked to Damien, and Damien thought that, you know, they really did destroy it to try to stop any testing from happening. But I just felt like they told us they had it. They told us they were packaging it. It couldn't have been destroyed years ago in a fire. And then I see on social media that there you are, Mara's still in here, is taking swings and still working to try to find the truth and justice in this case. So can you talk about what you've been doing with the case over the last year or so?
Okay, well, I was just finishing my last book, and that just came out in August. So as you were getting all of your good work done on this, Bob, I was deep into my other one and just following what was happening on your front from a distance and really, really cheering you on. But then once my book came out and all of a sudden I had some time, and then I began to realize that there's something happening here that where I could really play a role, and it was just simply because in this state, you have got to be a resident of the state to file a Freedom of Information request with officials of this state. And I knew that the attorneys had entered that battle and were doing it, and then were being stiffed. And boy, that crawled all over me. Our Freedom of Information Act is so important federally and in every state. And I feel that's why I go into stories where I think something's being hidden from us.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is really basic to me. I'm a First Amendment person. I believe that we need the information in order to have a democracy, and that is what is going to make us, this country, what it is or isn't. And so the idea that public officials would defy a state law regarding the release of information was real inflammatory to me. So that's when I decided that I would start filing. And then as soon as I saw that report from Prosecutor Cressman where he said that he's telling a public audience about evidence having been lost, and at the same time not responding to Freedom of Information request, and in fact, so the attorneys there are, of course, doing their own work. But I thought, from a public point of view, I can jump in there, and that's what I did. And then the first thing I did when I think it was the mayor who mentioned back in the summer that he thought it was he'd heard it was something about a fire, and that's when I thought, well, let's just see what the fire department has to say about that. And then there have been other FOI requests since then, which we can talk about.
Yeah, and I thought that was, I actually talked about it on my podcast a few months back, that what a brilliant move. We're all sitting here banging our heads against the wall trying to get FOIA requests through to the West Memphis Police Department and the DA's office. And then, I saw on social media that, Mara Leverett went the other way. And if they said it was burned up in a fire, you requested, you can explain the request, but it's essentially you asked the fire department to produce any records of fires at the police department. And if you want to share with people what you found with that.
Well, I asked for records on any city. I didn't ask about the police department. I just asked for any city-controlled property. And that was so that I would cover everything. I was just trying to make it as for any property owned or controlled by the city of West Memphis. And I figured that included the police department, and there wouldn't have been too many of them. So I went back in two separate requests. I covered 20 years, the past 20 years, and they did comply. They got back with me in a timely way and sent me records from two fires, neither of which amounted to much of anything. One had been, by the time the fire department got there, it had been extinguished with a fire extinguisher. And the other had been a very insignificant fire that had nothing to do with potentially storing evidence. And so I that was mystifying, wasn't it? Because we had this reference to fire, but the fire department's not coming up with anything that seems to fit the bill.
So, that was the first, that was kind of one of my first clues when I saw the results you got was, again, kind of confirming that they're lying about this, because, I have, as a fireman for 16 years, I know what kind of records we keep. And had there been a fire significant enough to destroy evidence in a police building, certainly there would be record of it. And it seemed to be that wasn't the case. And I thought I saw, did you say on social media recently, you had put something out that you found out about another fire that there wasn't a report for or something?
So that was just yesterday. I had obtained a number that I thought might have been a record number for the fire department. So I filed an FOI request, a new one with the fire department, asking specifically for this particular record by number. And the Chief Clay, got back to me in a matter of hours and said, we don't have anything by that number. And in fact, I realized it did not seem to correspond to the way that the numbers on the records that I had gotten looked. So it was kind of a shot in the dark. So he wrote back, and I said, well, I guess I must have gotten a wrong number there, or that I must have been incorrect, and I'll get back with you if I get anything more that looks better. And then quickly after that, he responded and sent me a police report, from the West Memphis Police Department that had that number on it that I had requested. So it was a police report. And he said, he just sent it to me and said, I think this may be what you're looking for. And so I appreciated that. I still did not understand. Oh, and then in that police report, it outlined what I then wrote about a fire in a storage building. But that police report that I saw for the first time yesterday said that the fire department was called and extinguished the blaze. So there's still a bit of a question for me about that would have fallen under the category of what I asked for of buildings owned or controlled. Maybe the squeamish part there is that I asked for buildings and this was a storage, a connex, a big, you know, one of those, it's almost like a container that would go on a container ship, you know, or a big metal container. And so maybe because it was in a structure like that, that was not actually a building, maybe that was what put it outside of the bounds of the way I had worded my FOI request to the fire department in the first place. I'm not sure exactly what happened. But at any rate, I can say that it was the fire chief who then provided me with the police report about that I wrote about yesterday in this storage, this connex box, as they call it, which it was where some evidence was reportedly burned.
Now, did I understand right? I thought I read that there was some stuff burned in the box, but then they found a box with West Memphis 3 evidence, like in a field or something, away from it.
Yeah, this is not very clear, and it's the way it often happens with things like this. But it's listed on this West Memphis police incident report as an arson with damage of more than $500, and it included also the theft of a firearm. And in this case, it looks like it was two that were valued at less than $2,500. So we don't know about all that. But it also says that there was, I'll just read exactly what the narrative here says, that on September 19th of 2016, at approximately 6:39 in the morning, as officers arrived to West Memphis Police Department range, officers observed smoke coming from the connex box that holds evidence. West Memphis Fire Department was notified and arrived on the scene at 6:50 hours. The fire was put out and the area was contained. CID was notified and upon arrival, the scene was processed. Evidence was located approximately 100 yards west of the connex container and was collected. Fire Chief Dwayne Rose was on the scene and ruled the fire an arson. Chief Rose collected fire debris from the area where the fire possibly started, and it is logged as evidence as well. That's the whole story, basically. And then there are some. There is another officer who also put in a note that he had collected a brown cardboard box that was previously stored in the connex that holds evidence for the West Memphis Police Department. The box was laying in a field approximately 100 yards from the connex. And then there was another one about that the firearm involved in another incident with the incident number for that was unaccounted for after the detailed inventory was completed. And at this time, that firearm is considered stolen and will be added into NCIC. So that's about all we know about what all that was. We have no idea what there's really nothing that mentions what we call the West Memphis 3 case by number that would tie. It doesn't say that, even though it lists the incident that the firearm was related to, but it does not list what the brown cardboard box might have been related to. So it's pretty ambiguous.
Right. And then there's a few things there. I think the mayor had said the fire that destroyed the evidence had occurred 15 years ago, and this was just 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. And then ultimately, as you mentioned, that the West Memphis Police Department was ignoring the requests Damien's attorneys had requested, and you had as well an evidence log showing what evidence is still available, where it's located, if any evidence had been destroyed, when, by whom, and under whose orders, and how. And they've been ignoring that, and then that went up to a higher court, and finally it was ruled, and they were ordered by a judge to produce that evidence or that the information for that FOIA request. And can you share what you finally got yours, what you found in your FOIA request once you got the report back?
Okay. Well, I had looked at what the attorneys had submitted in their request, and I sort of boiled it all down. They had a rather lengthy, 12, 13 items and so forth, and I just boiled them into four that I think basically say the same thing more succinctly. But I asked for all records cataloging the evidence in the West Memphis 3 case and identifying the locations of that evidence at the time of the cataloging. And I asked for all records referring to the loss, misplacement, or destruction of any evidence in the case. And I asked for all records identifying any policies or procedures to be followed by the WMPD in preserving evidence, including sources of potential DNA, seized in criminal cases. And finally, I asked for all records of communications between members of the WMPD, former prosecutor Scott Ellington, prosecutor Keith Cressman, personnel of the Arkansas State Crime Laboratory, and any third parties concerning evidence in the West Memphis 3 case since August 19, 2011, the date of the Alford. And so on last week I received a partial response to that request. And what they did was they did send me maybe 10-page spreadsheet of the various items of evidence. They also sent me the policy manual for the West Memphis Police Department, which talks about their policies about preserving evidence. So that is those are two of the three things I requested. I did not get, and still have not received, all records referring to the loss, misplacement, or destruction of any evidence, although this one that I got from the fire chief yesterday may be in part reference to that. And then the really interesting one to me that's not been answered is about records of communication between members of the West Memphis Police and prosecutors and so forth. So that's still hanging out there, and time has lapsed. It's overdue. It has not been complied with according to the law, which to me is very, very interesting when you have a police department that's not complying with the law. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal. So then, but to go back to what the catalog, the spreadsheet that they did send me, has got a lot of places, like a refrigerator and a vault crawl space and a storage room upstairs and a couple of different blue boxes that are identified, several different blue boxes, actually, and a whole bunch of items listed by exhibit numbers. And And then it says what all of these are specifically. And some of them are such as knives and blood samples and urine DNA kits from different people, a green rain jacket that was Jason's, a poem on white paper by Jason, and a blue toilet bowl cover taken from Jason's house. All these kinds of things are listed there, but then, of course, there are also some that are of very high interest to the attorneys because they're the things that they have wanted to have tested again and that they were looking to have tested when they were in negotiations with Scott Ellington.
And so I know that, you know, one of the things that we were wanting to have tested was on the top of our priority list was the ligatures from the shoelaces, the ligatures from Stevie, Michael, and Christopher. Were the ligatures listed in your records request as though they still have them and know where they are?
Yes. Yes. It looks like there are ligatures and I know that this hair from the perineum of Christopher Byers was one important hair everybody was interested in. Then there's another exhibit that is possible tissue from Christopher Byers' ligature, including skin, tissue, and hair from the ligature. Hair from Christopher Byers' body. Possible tissues from the ligature of Michael Moore. Hair from a ligature from Stevie Branch. Hair from Michael Moore ligature. Hair from the lower body of Christopher Byers, two dark Caucasian hairs from Stevie Branch, and so forth. So, yes, it seems there are ligatures listed for all three of the victims.
That's fantastic, and it's new hope breathed into the case again that insane fight. You know, we've had this fight for so long to test the evidence through the year of production. When I was filming the show, we were trying to get the evidence tested and couldn't get a response. Then we finally get Ellington to agree to it, and then they play this hide the ball trick where we don't have the evidence. It was obviously a huge letdown, and so now at least we're back to the place where we know that the evidence does exist. Now it's just a matter of whether Cressman is going to do the right thing and let us test it. And so we're gonna keep on fighting. I know I'm working with Damien and his legal team. I know you're gonna continue working on things from your end. But it's great to have that hope coming that the evidence at least has not been destroyed. At least most of the evidence, the stuff that we're looking for.
Yeah, I completely agree. And there were only two. What they sent me was titled an updated evidence list, updated. So I don't know from when to when, but anyway, that was how they titled it. And there were only two pieces of evidence that were listed as not found on this thing. And it was one called Exhibit 138 and another one called Exhibit 275 that were in a blue box, but it was listed in the storage room upstairs, which may be where it is, where they are now, or where they were supposed to be, but maybe where they were supposed to have been. But that's not a Connex. And there's actually nothing here that refers to anything being in a Connex container.
Right.
So that's also kind of puzzling to me. There's no reference at all to evidence in the column for evidence location. There's nothing that says anything like evidence being in a place like that. Maybe after there was a fire, assuming that there's something to this fire report, that it was all consolidated back somewhere else and things that had been there, you know, it's still very confusing where this evidence was moving around. And if in fact, whatever that fire report that I just that report about the fire in the Connex, if that really had anything at all to do with this case, we just don't know.
Right. Were you able to track down what those two missing items? I think I had read that Exhibit 138 was, I think I saw a photo, was actually one of the random sticks from the crime scene. Is that right?
I don't know that. I don't know what either one of those was.
Okay.
They were supposedly stored in a blue box with other things that were in that blue box. those two things that were in the blue box with other things like a T-shirt from Miss Kelly and a T-shirt from Jason and white tennis shoes of Jason and that toilet bowl cover, the blue toilet bowl cover.
Right.
Those were all, according to this, in the same, or are now in the same blue storage, in the same blue box number 6. But two of the items listed for that blue box are these two exhibits that are listed as not found. So there are still lots and lots of questions to be answered about this. But what it does say about what is there, if, for instance, it says a red-painted wooden stick was there. The bicycles, there were some question about the bicycles. The bicycles are reported to be still there. Also, I can't find it immediately, but I think sticks used to hold the clothing down in the water were also here in this list of things that they still have.
Well, that's great, because actually those are some of the items that our lab that does the MVAC testing wanted to test aside from the ligatures. So that's awesome. It's great work you've been doing. Before I let you go, I want to, you mentioned that you're writing a third book on the West Memphis 3 case. Do you have any prospect of when you might actually finish that thing up and when it might be published?
Well, actually, I said I was about to start on that when I got basically commissioned to do this other book about Mina. And so I did that. And right now, believe me, I'm taking a breather.
That's fair enough.
These things take years of my life. And so, but at the same time, I'm awfully glad that as these things, as information like this comes out, that I can still have a role to play along with you, Bob, in terms of just getting information out where I can. And I'll keep doing that.
Well, that's great. I mean, I'm in awe of the work you've done, and it's very impressive that you're still continuing to work on it. And so the last thing I want to tell you, so you have The Boys in the Tracks, you got The Devil's Knot. What was the name of your most recent book again?
My most recent one is called All Quiet at Mina. And then the one that maybe some of your listeners wouldn't have known about yet, but I'm really proud of it, is the one that Jason and I did together, and that's called Dark Spell.
Dark Spell. And can you get all those books on Amazon or wherever you get your books?
Yes, or links to them from my website, maralevert.com, either way.
Fantastic. Well, with that, Mara, I will let you go, and thank you again so much for taking the time to join me today.
Well, this was great. I hope we can do it again, and hope that there's really a lot to talk about next time.
Let's hope so. You have a great day.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye, Bob.
Bye.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing and sound engineered by Shane Yoder. All music for the show is created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. All of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, Erica Cantor, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that always include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. To become a patron, just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And Lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. And I personally can be found on social media at Bob Ruff Truth, and Mike can be found at Murb Gaming, MURRBGAMING. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.
Say goodbye to the dish and hello to Sky Stream, the new way to get Sky over Wi-Fi. So you can get unmissable Sky shows like The Last of Us and Succession, as well as Netflix and Discovery Plus, and loads more, all in one subscription for £26 a month. Oh, and next day delivery with no upfront fee. Sky Stream, TV simplified. Head to sky.com. Requires Sky Stream and broadband minimum speed 10 megabits per second, 18-month minimum term. Cut-off times apply for next day delivery. Excludes bank holiday. 18 plus, terms apply.